Welcome to Researching Peace, the podcast proudly presented by the Department of Peace and Conflict Research at Uppsala University. Over the next few episodes, we'll take a closer look at how AI is impacting the field of peace and conflict research with my colleagues at the department. I'm joined by Jim Dale and Merk John Yilmaz today. A warm welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. So how do you feel about being in a podcast?
I mean, it's not something new for me, as I've been on the producing side of this podcast.
Exactly. You've been here for every episode we've done.
Yeah.
It is something new for me, so I don't know, really. Curious, I suppose, to see how it goes.
You're so welcome, both of you. And Merk, it's very nice to have you move from the technical side to actually know more about your research and what you're doing here at the department.
Being on the other side of the microphone.
Yeah. Exactly.
Exciting.
I think for the listeners, it's good if we start with what you're doing at the department. Jim, let's start with you.
I work for the project called VIEWS, which is the Violence Early Warning System, which is a forecasting project which tries to actually forecast or tell in advance over the next 3 years how much politically related violence there is going to be in the world.
Great. And Matt?
I've been working for UCDP, Uppsala Conflict Data Program. I'm a senior analyst in there. What we are doing is we are gathering conflict data from all around the world.
Fantastic. So, Jim, I know that you have been in the field of astrophysics before. So I'm very interested in to know what brought you from star formation to more earthly matters.
Yeah, that's right. Till 3 years ago, I was a lecturer actually in astrophysics in the UK. So a number of things, mainly the, shall we say, declining political situation in the UK with the Brexit disaster. But I think I had also become, I know this sounds strange, a little bit bored of astrophysics. I thought I probably knew about as much about it as I really wanted to. And I was finding that my job as a lecturer was becoming very, very teaching heavy and not so much involving research. I like teaching, but I don't want to be doing it all the time. And I found I wasn't getting much time for research anymore. So I decided it was time for a change. I moved to Sweden to join my wife, who is Swedish and already lived here. And I started looking for jobs. And I saw an advert for a programmer wanted by the Violence Early Warning System project in Uppsala. And I thought, well, let's see what it's like. And I'm still here 3 years later.
We're happy about that. And you, Merk, you also have kind of a different background. You recently wrote about religion and AI for your theology masters, and from more transcendental issues to, again, earthly matters, just like Jim.
I explored the intersection of AI, specifically AI alignment and societal beliefs. For people who don't know about this concept, AI alignment refers to ensuring that artificial intelligence systems act in ways that are in line with human values or human intentions. As AI systems gain autonomy, it's essential that they make decisions that are beneficial and desired by us, by humans. And with this in mind, my research focused on how religion could shape individuals' expectations of AI alignment strategies formed by these big tech companies. I found out that those who are religiously affiliated expect AI to reflect their personal beliefs. And very unsurprisingly, the more devout individuals believe that AI should reflect the core values of their own religious doctrines.
Back to you, Jim. Can you briefly explain what AI is and how it's used in peace and conflict research?
I don't know if I can explain it briefly, because AI
is... We have 5 hours?
Yeah, exactly.
Just joking.
AI is a very... It's what you might call an umbrella term for a whole lot of different technologies. It means different things to different people. To Tesla, it means teaching a car to be able to drive itself in heavy traffic, for example.
Do you drive Tesla?
No, I drive a normal car. A lot of AI is, in a sense, trying to make computers able to do tasks that humans can do but machines can't. So driving a car is actually quite a complicated task for a machine, and even it takes a human months to learn how to do it. In peace and conflict research, it's something rather different. We use artificial intelligence in the sense of using computers to find often very subtle patterns in data, which it would be either very difficult or impossible for a human being to do themselves. If you think of the graph which is often presented in climate change conferences of CO2 concentration against global temperature, it's a nice straight line.
Yes.
And anyone can see, and a computer can easily also see, that there's a correlation between those two things. But if you're looking at conflict, you might think conflict is influenced by a whole range of things, like also climate, economic factors, societal factors, political factors. If you manage to reduce all these to numbers of some kind and you're looking for patterns in those numbers, you would have to draw a graph with many, many different dimensions, which is completely impossible to imagine or visualize. Mm-hmm. There is no way a human being could possibly find any patterns in that in a data set like that. But it's something which a computer can, in principle, do. So a computer can look through this enormous mass of data, which will be completely overwhelming to a human, quite quickly, and it can find very subtle patterns which a human would easily miss. And in principle, then, you can maybe use those patterns to try to predict what's going to happen in the future from what's already happened in the past. And that's essentially what we do in the VIEWS project.
It evokes so many questions, but we're not going to stay in this right now. We're going to move forward, and maybe we come back to this again later. Marit, how would you say that AI has transformed the way we study and address peace and conflict research?
It has kind of revolutionized various aspects of social science research methodologies. Its ability to quickly process large data sets means that real-time or near-real-time analysis is now feasible. And similar to models developed at the VIEWS project, machine learning models can now forecast potential conflict hotspots by analyzing current data informed by or trained on historical conflict patterns. It can also monitor sources like social media, news media, for early signs of conflict onsets, and potentially paving the way for preemptive interventions. So an example is the project that I'm working on. Many of our listeners may be familiar with the Uppsala Conflict Data Program. And
yeah, it's world famous, I would say. Yeah.
So with the enhanced computational powers and also with the enhanced AI methodologies and applications, it means that we can gather and extract conflict data even more efficiently at UCDP. There is this project in PRIO, Peace Research Institute, Oslo, called Peace Science Infrastructure, and it's a new promising venture aiming to create automated data collection tools for news and social media. And UCDP is also part of it, so we are trying to use whatever AI systems can provide for us.
Wow. So let's go back to views a little bit. Jim, you were talking on patterns that you've seen. Can you tell me anything about those patterns?
Well, that's actually a good question because, so yes, a computer can, if you give it this enormous mass of data, which, as I said, if you tried to draw it on a graph rather than having just two things like temperature and atmospheric CO2, which you can draw on a graph with two dimensions because you just have two things to plot. In VIEWS, we have a colossal mass of data from many different sources. So we have data on past conflicts, which is very important. But we also have data on economic matters within countries, political systems, climate data, prices of various commodities like food and water and such like. So we have all these different variables, if you like, each of which would form a dimension on our graph. So you'd have to draw a graph with lots of different dimensions, as I said, which you can't possibly visualize. You can't draw it. You can't even imagine it. It's impossible. Mm. But you can feed all this data into a computer and ask it to look for patterns between all these things and the thing you're really interested in, conflict. And it will find those patterns. But then the question becomes, well, can the computer explain to you what those patterns actually are? Mm-hmm. This is what's something called explainable AI, where you can come up with the computer can come up with a model.
Yes.
And it may allow you to make predictions, but can you then look at the model and say, right, well, I can see that, say, conflict explains most of what's going on here and climate explains some of it, and then maybe economic factors explain the rest. This is actually surprisingly difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's not completely impossible, but it's surprisingly difficult to do. So often you're left with the problem where you can make quite good predictions.
Yes.
So you can actually forecast things accurately. But if somebody asks you, well, right, so but what are the most important things here? The most important things that make the predictions come true, if you like. It can be quite difficult to isolate. We know that past conflict is by far the best predictor of future conflict. If there's a war going on in a country this month, it's quite likely it will still be going on next month. But it doesn't explain all of the prediction power that we have.
Can you give an example of a prediction that AI have seen?
One thing that we actually do find very difficult is predicting when a new war or new conflict is going to start or when one that's already going on is actually going to stop. We can predict reasonably well when they're going to get worse or better, but predicting when they're actually going to start or stop, which would be an amazing thing if we could do it, is extremely difficult. This is what Mert was referring to earlier as onsets.
Yes. Mm.
These are extremely hard to predict because then obviously previous conflict is very difficult to predict. An onset from a previous conflict, you would then have to rely on the other prediction factors like the economics and such like.
Mm.
But these, on their own, are not very good predictors. So it becomes extremely difficult to do this, actually.
Yeah. Marty, felt like you were thinking of something.
I was just thinking that since Jim mentioned these historical conflict patterns are quite important in this work, at UCDP, that's what actually we are also trying to provide. We have UCDP candidate data, where we provide monthly data sets. And it is primarily for forecasting people who are trying to forecast conflicts.
It sounds so fantastic if you could predict all conflicts that are going to happen in the future. But it's not exactly how this is going to...
Who knows? There is this TV series called Person of Interest. I don't know if you know it. So it's like...
I do.
Maybe in the future. So.
Well, then, but also then you have the... supposing we could make really accurate predictions, mm-hmm. which we published.
Yes.
And somebody who was like, I don't know, Vladimir Putin, who was thinking of starting a war, sees, someone has predicted I'm going to start a war next month. Maybe I'll wait till the month after. No. Then you have this problem where your predictions would actually start to influence the actual outcome. Mm. So you would have to include the effect of your predictions in your predictions, which starts to become really brain-hurtingly difficult.
Yeah.
But at the moment, in general, our predictions are not really accurate enough to use in that way. So we are quite good at predicting whether a given conflict is going to get a bit better or a bit worse. But we're not, at the moment, very good at predicting when a completely new conflict is going to start.
It feels like we're moving into questions on AI ethics here. How do you ensure that AI tools used in peace and conflict research don't accidentally amplify biases or lead to unjust outcomes? Just as you were saying, almost.
Yeah.
Mert.
Again, maybe it would be good to mention AI alignment discussions, because overarching AI systems can accidentally create problematic outcomes if they're not aligned with universal human values in general. What are those values? That's another
exactly. It's a big
philosophical debate. But it's kind of essential to ensure that the training data employed by these systems are representative and devoid of specific biases. And this is quite challenging. That's the thing that worries many people. We can also consider very famous ChatGPT now. So it's based on a prominent large language model called GPT-4. And some argue that it actually exhibits some sort of Western bias. You can imagine that these systems are trained with large text data, and bulk of its training data comes from English language. So there is this underrepresentation of other languages, and in a way, it leads to underrepresentation of other cultures. AI researchers should constantly test and validate these models to pinpoint these biases. But the problem is there is this gap. There are relatively few people working on AI alignment, relatively few people working on these biases, whereas there are probably thousands of AI developers, machine learning engineers around the world. So we should kind of integrate more social scientists into this space, and that could bridge this gap.
Just help me understand, what could those Western biases be?
It can be political biases mm-hmm. in certain contexts. During my research on religion and AI, for instance, there was this study where people were asking religious advice to these large language models.
Mm-hmm.
And these advices are kind of informed by Western understanding of religions. But overall, we need to conduct more and more research on this to exactly pinpoint where the bias is.
There will be other ones, though, which are so subtle, it'll be very difficult to see, I would guess. And if you don't know where they come from, it's very difficult to remove them. And you often, if you try to fiddle with a complex system that you don't really understand, you're almost inevitably going to introduce other biases that you don't want. It's exactly like when governments try to influence the behavior of financial markets to behave in certain ways, almost always produces the opposite result or another unintended result that you don't want. If you're trying to influence a complex system that you don't really understand. And these large language models are now so complex that I think it's probably safe to say that they're not themselves fully understood, even by the people who created them.
And one other problem is they answer so authoritatively.
Yes.
So
even when they are completely wrong.
Wrong. Yeah. Then this basically creates false stories, false narratives, false news articles.
AI have become mansplaining.
Yeah.
The problem with it is that when you talk to it, it does sound like you're talking to a human, but you absolutely aren't.
There is a literature on AI anthropomorphism. You start thinking that this is actually a human-like creator. So, and once you have this mindset, your relationship with the answers that it gave is different than before.
I've noticed when I use ChatGPT for translations or stuff like that, I accidentally say like, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't meant to." So I'm being polite. So
yeah, I do that with Siri sometimes as well. And I think, why are you apologizing to a machine?
Yeah, because
Because in somewhere in your brain, your exactly. brain has started to think this is a person you're talking to, which is actually quite dangerous.
Yes, yeah.
Well, some of these models, at least, are designed to fool you into thinking that they're a person. This is like the Turing test, which is supposed to tell you when an AI has reached a sufficient level to be called intelligent, is when it can fool you into thinking it's a human.
Mm.
So this could be dangerous.
If we connect this to peace and conflict research, then what are your thoughts?
Well, fortunately, the models that we use in our forecasting are absolutely nothing like this. They are just pattern finding, very complicated pattern finding devices. They're not trying to fool you into thinking or doing anything, and you don't talk to them in any way. I suppose it could get to the point where you put too much faith in them, but I mean, we don't forecast that far into the future, and it's quite easy to test. You could just have to wait. We don't forecast more than 36 months into the future. So if you want to see how good a model is, you just have to wait a few years and see how compare your prediction as to what actually happened. Mm. That immediately tells you whether you can trust the model or not.
Mm.
So it's a very different issue to talking to ChatGPT and maybe following its advice on something that you shouldn't.
But what will happen when you start to see that these patterns actually are right?
It's going to give you opportunity to develop some preemptive interventions.
Yeah, like you said, like Jim said, with Vladimir Putin.
Well, supposing rather than he's decided to wait a month, supposing he says, well, people have predicted I'm going to go to war next year, I'll go to war right now.
Yeah, but is it a bad thing then to use AI? What do you say, Mike?
I think it's inevitable that we are going to use AI in social science, in peace and conflict research. The only thing is we need to figure out what are the challenges and we need to figure out how to address those challenges.
Mm.
This is difficult because it's a very fast-moving field.
Yeah.
So,
And again, the problem is, as I said, every tech company around the world is trying to develop these advanced tools right now. But there are, again, relatively less people working on AI ethics, working on AI alignment. So social scientists are needed.
Jim, how accurate have these AI-driven predictions been in the past?
Well, even that is a surprisingly difficult question to answer. So we make and have made in the past different kinds of forecasts. The simplest forecasts that we ever tried to make, which we still do make, are so we try to forecast every month from next month up to 36 months into the future. Every country in the world, which is about 200 countries, I think, at the moment.
Oh, my God.
For a computer, that's actually surprisingly easy. It just takes a few seconds. And the most basic forecast we make is there going to be conflict or not? Are there going to be more than 25 battle-related deaths in this country in this month or not? Yes or no?
Yeah.
It's a very simple forecast. And those forecasts are usually pretty accurate. Because, again, if there is conflict in a given country right now, there's almost certainly going to be conflict in that same country next month, 6 months into the future, and such like. But we're now trying to make a much more useful and accurate set of forecasts where we actually try to forecast not just yes or no, but actually how many people are going to be killed in battle.
This is scary in a way, isn't it?
Yes. It's actually quite unpleasant because, I mean, these just are numbers that come out of the computer, but they represent deaths.
Yeah, and it feels like playing God in a way. Maybe I'm out of wrong here. But
think of it this way. So if you can predict where a conflict will happen and how many will be affected, you can also try to develop some tools to intervene it beforehand.
That's the ultimate goal. Right. So
you can inform UN missions, for instance, and say that you should be careful about this and that region.
Yeah.
So
in that sense, it's of course very, very good. Yeah.
Yeah, we have more, I guess you might say, fine-grained predictions where we have divided the whole world up into a grid where every square is about 55 by 55 kilometers. It's half a degree by half a degree on the surface of the Earth. So we also make forecasts at that geographical levels. We also try to say there's not just going to be conflict in, say, Mali. It's going to be here near the border, for example, which would be of much more use to an aid agency. We're not telling them just go to Mali, but go to this spot, in principle at least. But again, these forecasts are much more difficult to make because there are more ways of being wrong if you have more places where you can make predictions.
Mm.
If I predict there are going to be 100 fatalities in one grid cell, and in fact there are 100, but in the next grid cell, to the north, say, that's still quite good. But how do I decide how good it is? Is it better to be out by one grid cell with the right number of fatalities or to get the wrong number of fatalities in exactly the right grid cell? Is that surprisingly hard to say how good is this prediction?
I'm very interested. How does it feel to work with these issues?
Well, I have to admit, I have to spend most of my time pretending that these are just numbers. I find thinking about the implications quite depressing a lot of the time, especially when the numbers get very big, because that means lots of casualties.
At UCDB, we are recording these casualties. We are reading news articles, we are reading social media posts, and we are one by one checking who died where. But I think to begin with, for documentation purposes, it's important. We are recording every life. These are people who were affected by violence, wars around the world, and someone needs to keep the records. So this is kind of important for me.
Agreed. So, it is important. It's just not a job I think I can do.
If we look ahead, how do both of you envision the role of AI in peace and conflict research in, let's say, the next decade?
Well, it's only going to grow. Certainly from the point of view of the VUES project, we are always developing new methods to look for patterns in different ways. So we've actually just started working with a new researcher in Oslo who's joined our collaboration, who looks at so you can make a map of what these conflicts look like. So you can record how many casualties there are in each of these grid cells, and you can essentially make looks like a movie. You can play it in time. And you can use techniques developed for computer vision, which are designed to analyze images and videos. In fact, some of the technology used in self-driving cars works in this way. It analyzes moving images to try to determine what's going to happen next. And you can actually treat these sort of successive conflict maps moving forward in time like a video and ask a very different kind of artificial intelligence tool called a neural network, which is designed to mimic how the visual parts of the brain work. You can ask it to forecast, right, this is the movie up to here. What are the next 25 frames going to look like? Mm. That is something which we have never tried before and is completely new technology and, again, very fast moving. I think the influence certainly in forecasting is only going to grow, and hopefully it will make the forecast more accurate, possibly to the point where policyholders and aid agencies and such like actually really find them not just useful but essential.
There are also great AI-assisted governance and diplomacy tools, and I can anticipate that the improvement of these tools will have significant impacts on, for instance, peace negotiations. I think it's an exciting time to be alive, and it's an exciting time to be working in this field, in both peace and conflict and in the world of artificial intelligence. And I think these collaborations between AI experts and peace researchers will likely deepen, leading to more tailored AI tools for researchers, which is something we also aim for in the Peace Science Infrastructure project based in Norway.
Before we end this, any last thoughts you have on AI and peace and conflict research?
I think the AI's potential in peace and conflict research is immense, but ethical and responsible usage is a must for maximizing benefits and curtailing risks associated with it.
Yes, I would certainly agree with that last part. And as you said before, that is something which is receiving very little, if any, attention right now. So if anybody listening is interested in the impact of AI ethics and peace and conflict research, then why did you apply to the work at the department?
That's a great end. Mert and Jim, this has been extremely interesting. Thank you so much for being part of Researching Peace.
It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.